This is a presentation that I've been making at colleges this semester. And a little background on the topic. I was inspired to present something on this from about 2 years ago when I was the chairman of the GBC, and towards the end of being the GBC chairman, it was in the summer, in the late summer, the terrible disaster in Haiti happened. And I was thinking, gee, worldwide spiritual organization should do something about this, and I'm the chairman of this worldwide organization. I have to do something about it. In the past, somebody else would think about it, so I didn't even think about it. Like being a brain dead member of the organization. But when it came to have to do something, what's appropriate? What do you do in a situation like this? Especially given our teachings and so forth. So what happened was so many people started writing saying, hey, what are we going to do about this? And some people saying, you know, I'd like to help. Is there some way that I can be of some help? So just started trying to be practical and thinking, Haiti is a place where we don't have a temple. The nearest place is Santo Domingo. So I know a devotee in Santo Domingo. I called the devotee in Santo Domingo and said, could you be the point person? There's all these individuals that want to help. He said, I've never been to Haiti. I don't speak French, but I can help coordinate. And so people from around the world started mobilizing and resources and funds, and we had a point person. And it was inspiring to see the range of people that had an interest to like just take out a chunk of their time and go and do something. I was passing through London when a group, they had all decided to meet at the Heathrow Airport and they were going to go straight to Haiti. London to Haiti, I guess. And somebody from Australia that knew how to build houses from next to nothing. Somebody from Sweden that knew how to supply me some seeds, and I'll show them how to like grow their own food, not just like feed them, but grow their own food. And somebody else that was good at this thing, and somebody else was good at that thing. And there was like 12 of them, and they were all off on their way to Haiti. Just happened to pass through Heathrow Airport and saw them. And I asked them, you know, aside from these things, the medical things and the other practical things, what's the spiritual plan? I said, well, of course, we're taking along Jaffa beads and song books. We get whatever literature we can in French. And because it's not just putting people's material lives back together. They've been smashed. And so their spiritual well-being is also something that we're planning to minister to attend to. So that was really nice. And then towards the end of my GBC chairmanship, something in Chile happened. Not of the same scale as in Haiti, but, you know, another disaster. And so we marshaled some people together and some similar efforts. I didn't personally go, but just like was the lightning rod for sending people to this location and this person, and somebody coordinated. And then we had our GBC meeting, and I was exhausted. I never made this presentation. So some time passed, and then next year the Japan thing happened. And I thought, you know, I want to speak about this. So that's where the title comes from and the inspiration comes from. We've made some presentations at some schools, MIT and Illinois Institute of Technology and at Penn State, those three, there were, side by side with this, we contacted the Japanese Student Association, so they, what was that?
Walker's going down.
Okay.
Somebody must have flushed.
Okay. Water flowing down. They came to the program, and we had this presentation, and afterwards was a fundraising dinner, whatever proceeds, whatever people gave. We had prior arrangements, and it was sent to Food for Life Global, because they have in Japan, at least at that time. There were 34 devotees from Nepal and a group from some other parts of Europe and some Japanese devotees, and they were doing what they could do. Again, not just feeding people, but administering different types of welfare activity and, of course, Krishna consciousness. So the first slide here is lotus flower, and I explained to the audiences that the reason for selecting lotus flower at the beginning is because, in general, the lotus has an image that indicates or symbolizes peace or the beauty of nature, or in different traditions of religion, some symbol of spirituality. Then I explained to them, so I'll just share this with you in this way. For me, the lotus brings the image of Krishna, who is the origin of all compassion, or the reservoir of that quality of compassion. Within the Vedic model of creation, there is the universe in which there are many planets, so many you can't count them, innumerable planets, and those planets within this universe, they're encased by a shell. It's like a coconut with planets inside and a nice big shell. The shell is in size 7 layers, each layer 10 times the size of the previous one, and the first one is the same, it's 10 times the diameter of the universe, times 7 more of those. You do the math, Sariputta did the math once and said that if the universe is like a little marble, you know, like 3/4 of an inch in diameter, the coverings of the universe would expand several miles. And then outside coverings of the universe, there's the vastness of the spiritual sky. And in that vastness of the spiritual sky, there are spiritual planets called Vaikuntha planets. And in those, amongst those Vaikuntha planets, there's one that's shaped like a lotus. And in the whirl of the lotus is where Krishna and Radha and all the associates of Krishna are engaged in their loving pastimes together. And in that spiritual realm, Krishna is the abode of all compassion. So that's the starting point. Remember Krishna. It's just a nice way to get them to remember Krishna. So here's some definitions of compassion taken directly from dictionary. There's two. One definition is the quality of understanding the suffering of others and wanting to do something about it. So three things here. It's a quality. It's second thing is it's concern for others, and specifically it's understanding their concern and The third is understanding the concern, action, or a desire to do something practical. Another is a deep awareness and sympathy for another's suffering. So these are the two definitions, and just summarizing again, compassion is a quality. It's something that's deep within an individual, at the very core of your being. You feel something, and that feeling compels action. And are caring for their well-being. This is a... the colors are very different here and there. But after I made this presentation at Penn State, one of the organizers of the Penn State program sent a link to a speaker from, I don't know if I'm saying this properly, but TED, T-E-D, is a speaker's guild. They feature people that are really good speakers, and they have their rules, and the rules are you have 20 minutes, and in these 20 minutes you have to completely present your thing from beginning to end with some inspiration and some action items. They have some standards. So the link, it was a YouTube link from TED, where the speaker was an employee from Google. And his theme was how Google, in their the culture of the Google organization, is compassion. And then he was describing two things. His main job, although he was joking that I'm an engineer, but I've been given this full-time post with Google to teach a course on emotional intelligence. Have you heard that term, anyone here? Emotional intelligence? It's a trendy term. It's going to come up in a little bit later. Emotional intelligence is... how to not be ruled by your emotions, but how to become detached from your emotions and direct the mind and your affective part of your life towards uplifting yourself and others. I don't know if that's the best way to describe it, but in these definitions of compassion, so he took this little chart is taken directly from his presentation. There's an affective component of compassion, something that you feel towards another. A cognitive component, something that you understand about another's situation. And a motivational component, you want to do something for another. So he doesn't call it emotional intelligence, he calls it something else. And all the Google employees have to take this seminar that he gives, and it's a multiple day seminar. And it's the purpose of it is to have a better environment in the workplace and to have better quality leadership in their different groups, because like Microsoft, they work in groups. So groups have our teams, and teams have a common goal. And so how to have the team work smoothly, they have this feature. He made reference to a book, maybe here's another reference you know, From Good to Excellent, speaking about organizations, what makes an organization really good, or leadership of an organization, really good leadership. And the distinction between good and excellent, the author says, is these two main things, humility and ambition, that the leader isn't just thinking about getting ahead for himself or for the organization, just get ahead, just win, compete, and achieve, and produce more, or sell more, or more profit. That's not the excellent leader, but the excellent leader has these components of compassion. They understand, and they have a feeling for the needs of others. Their ego is, their own personal ego is out of the way. Instead, they're compassionate by nature, thinking of the well-being of others, and they're highly motivated, whoops, to achieve that. What do we do here?
Remind me in 60 minutes. The center button. The center blue button at the bottom.
At the bottom.
Yeah, that
one. Okay. You can't just tell them to go away, huh? Take that out. So humility is a necessary quality for leadership in excellence, that is devoid of false ego, but very strong in this feature of compassion. And in the feature of compassion, the motivation or the ambition is to fulfill the needs of others. The excellent leader has these two components. So that's an essential part of Google wants their employees to be good, or they want them to be excellent, and so they're having him train them in this system. But it's a feature of strengthening compassion. It sounds contradictory. If you're compassionate, maybe you're like soft and not effective, just compassionate. But the other part is very highly motivated, just like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or Prahlad Maharaj or personalities in our spiritual line that have very strong desire to bring spiritual well-being into the lives of the world that's suffering. So here's some quotes on compassion to help assist in this topic. You know who this gentleman is? And what is Albert Einstein having to say about compassion? Very interesting quote. Our task must be to free ourselves by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty. So if you want to be able to think out of the box, think with freedom, in a liberated state of not confined condition of consciousness, increase your compassion. And how far can you increase your compassion? He's got a very big circle. All living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty. There's one devotee, Saradiya Dasi, whose disciple of Prabhupada, was told me that she once asked Prabhupada, when we're chanting japa, we know that the chanting of the holy name is the prime benediction for all humanity at large, because it spreads the rays of the benediction, Lord, and so on. So when we're chanting, is it alright, Prabhupada, to think about how the holy name is beneficial for all living beings? And Prabhupada's reply was, what is your capacity to think of all living beings? Just pay attention to the holy name. That's where your attention should go. But when you do pay attention to the holy name, something happens. And that something that happens is you become cleansed, and your concern goes beyond your immediate selfish concern into the concern for the well-being of others. If this happens, compassion is something that awakens as you become spiritually awakened. And he wasn't, Sadhana Bhakta, but the principle is you expand your spiritual well-being, naturally the compassion or for the well-being of others expands, and that allows you to think far more freely. It's far more confining to be in a position of selfishness. Is far more liberating to be in a position of compassion. Now here's another gentleman, you know who this is too. Dalai Lama spoke this: if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. Meaning many things, but one of them is compassion is commonly thought of as the concern for others. That's compassion. So if you have concern for others, you wish them to be happy, practice compassion. And if you're selfish, you want to be happy, practice compassion. Because the compassionate person becomes happy, be compassionate if you want happiness. It's a win-win. It's beneficial for all. And the next picture you'll also recognize. Christ also spoke about compassion. And here's one of his statements. Knowledge and ritual without compassion is empty. In any religious tradition, there's some rituals. When it's a common thing that I've experienced as I have been in different temples, that professors of world religion or even like Bible study groups or different things like that, they bring groups, the professor or teacher brings their group of students to the Hare Krishna temple to experience what our tradition is. They come at a time when they can observe what they consider to be our rituals, because that's how they distinguish. In world religion classes, that's how they teach. This religion has this ritual, that religion has that ritual. Literally, they teach it that way. So they come for greeting the deities, because that's a ritual. And then Guru Puja, because that's one of our rituals. And then Srimad Bhagavatam class. There's a little ritual before the Srimad Bhagavatam class, and then they hear the class, and then they ask lots of questions and get some prasadam, and off they go. So wherever and whatever the rituals are that make up some religion, or the theology, the religious teaching, different rituals, different theology, but whatever that is, without compassion, it's empty. The life of the ritual, the life of the knowledge is the quality of compassion that's there. It's the life of religion, at least in Christ's description here. Who is this one? Vyasadeva. Very good. Vyasadeva compiled the Vedas out of compassion. This is described in the first canto, chapter 4, where Vyasa, being able to see past, present, and future equally, he looked into the future and he saw that Kali Yuga was coming, and it was, yikes, it's awful. Seeing the details of how awful, he wanted to do something. He felt compassion. And so he took it upon himself to take all of the Vedas and take it from an oral tradition and put it in a written form. And he made it easily accessible by dividing it into four and explained it to the Smriti portion of the Vedas. So, Vyasadeva's statement about compassion, one of them is, great philanthropic souls travel on earth on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead to show compassion to the fallen souls who are averse to the sense of subordination to the Lord. So, Vyasadeva's consideration or conception of compassion was specifically to reconnect souls with their lost relationship with the Supreme Lord. And that's the supreme act of compassion. Even it's challenging because they're averse to that subordination, still nonetheless taking it upon themselves to make that connection. That's compassion in Vyasadeva's words. And of course,
Krishna telling Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna.
Bhagavad Gita. You got it right first time. And what's that behind Krishna?
Arjuna.
No. Behind Krishna.
Oh, Vishnu.
Universal form, right. Okay. So Krishna, out of compassion, he took Arjuna out of ignorance and presented the message of Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna to relieve him of his ignorant condition, suffering condition, unhappy condition, and enlightened him in transcendental knowledge. Here's a quote from Krishna, not from Bhagavad Gita, but from Srimad Bhagavatam. Showing compassion to all living entities, you will attain self-realization. Giving assurance of safety to all, you will perceive your own self as well as all the universes in me and myself in you. That's amazing, isn't it? This is the truth of compassion. Self-realization, and what is that? The makeup of self-realization, to see your own self as well as all universes in me. So all universes are in Krishna. How big is the universe? Big. And all the universes, all of the universe, how big is Krishna? He's bigger than all the universes. And then Krishna is in you. How big are you? But an expansion of Krishna. So Krishna is both inside and outside. And everything within Krishna and everything is not within Krishna. Like he describes in the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. But the fruit of it is self-realization. And of course, God-realization. By this wonderful quality of compassion. So this is from the 3rd canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And here's Srila Prabhupada speaking on compassion. That is the definition of compassion. One who cannot bear the sufferings of another. Great unalloyed devotees of the Lord are compassionate towards the fallen, and therefore they travel all over the world with the mission of bringing souls back to Godhead, back to home. Sounds very much like what Vyasadeva had to say about the nature of compassion. Now here's a little humorous part. Commonly we think of compassion as one human to another human or group of humans. But sometimes there's compassion of humans towards nature, humans towards other species of life. Save the whales, save the porpoises. There was a property that we were looking to purchase in the suburbs of Chicago. And it was like at a very low price and on the market for a long time. We figured there must be something wrong with the property. So we did some little research. We found out there were salamanders in some wet portion of the property. And so the environmentalists, you know, they had all these super duper restrictions about what you couldn't do. And it was so intense. We just, you know, like everybody else, we just walked away. It was too much to deal with. Save the salamanders. But it's a human experience, commonly. So here's some little photos of where it's not just humans to others, but others to others. Starting with a little pussycat. There's a little pussycat by the side of a wall. And he has a little puppy looking at the pussycat, not really sure what the pussycat's going to pounce on him or what she's going to do. But he's very tired. So he cuddles up with the pussycat and they both fall asleep, very happy together. I guess a dove or some kind of a bird. Here's another. You normally don't think of giraffes as compassionate, but this one is. And a squirrel is happily accepting the compassion of a giraffe.
Giraffe.
Here's another. Mother hen keeping little baby puppy warm. Even her own little chick is at the side, paying attention to the little baby puppy first. Here's another. I don't have my laser pointer, but you can see the third one over from the right is a little different than all the other ones. So these furry animals, they're called something something cat. Does somebody know the name? Meerkat. Meerkat? Meerkat. So the animal can stand up on their hind leg like this, they're like looking to see if there's any danger coming to harm them. So this other cat is like part of the team, helping the other cats. Nice cooperative effort. But it's not always like that. It's sometimes like this. So we want to avoid this one and go for the other one. Okay, so as the heading indicates, what are some contemporary examples of how in our modern society people are exhibiting compassion? And one of them is this one, nonviolent communication. Marshall Rosenberg has from somewhere in Southern California, Southwest USA, he's based. And just as nonviolence is an expression of compassion, so how you communicate, say the same message, the same content is transmitted from person A to person B, and it can be done compassionately or it can be done violently or harshly or abrasively or without considering the other person at all. Bir Krishnawar, some of you know him, has took his Marshall Rosenberg's full course. It's a 5-day course or something like that, and he showed me some of the videos. He has these little hand puppets and explains how speech can impact how another person feels. You can, by speech, you can make another person saying the same thing. We give examples. So one of them is a jackal. Jackal speak goes rah, 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 rah. And then another one is a giraffe, and he says it the same thing very nicely, pleasingly. Just like in Bhagavad Gita, 18th chapter, it said the austerity of speech, what's the rest? Is to speak the truth pleasingly. So part of the quality of goodness is to speak the truth, but it's even more challenging to speak the truth pleasingly, because sometimes the truth isn't palatable. So how do you speak that which is not palatable pleasingly? But to try to do that is quality of goodness. And that's what his message is. It's very popular. A number of persons I know are tuned into his message. And it's a contemporary example of compassion. Compassionate speech or nonviolent speech. Nonviolent communication. And as I move around on college campuses in particular, social activism amongst young people is becoming more and more like very important, very, very trendy. 2 years ago, studies were made for entering freshmen in colleges in the United States and another similar study in Europe. And the first question was, what's the basis that you're using for determining the career that you want to take up from your college education? And the answer was this one. It was, I want to involve myself with something that's going to make a significant contribution to the quality of life of people on earth. And then the next question, well, how important is how much money you make? The answer is, that's not what's important. What's important, because, and then they to fill it in, you know, my parents make plenty of money, and I see they're not happy, and I see they're also not adding quality either to their lives or to the world that we live in, and I don't want to go down the same path just to make some money. I want to make a difference. I want my little bit, make my little part in making a difference in the quality of life. I could elaborate, but it's a very strong theme in young people, at least, you know, college age presently. And I see in different older generations of persons. It's becoming more and more so. A number of students, when they ask them, when you graduate, what's your plan? Many of them say, I'm going to take off a couple of years and go dedicate to something. So, just volunteer for some cause. Peace Corps, when I was in college, was a big thing. I thought it just like ended. But it's there are lots of persons. They graduate. First thing that they're going to do, they're not going to make some money. The first thing they're going to do is dedicate 2 years of going to Costa Rica or Guatemala or somewhere and just receive next to nothing, just maintenance and serve Peace Corps. It's a modern expression, contemporary expression of compassion. You understand the circumstance of another person's difficulties, you're moved, you're to the core of your spirit, you want to do something, and you take practical actions to remedy the need. And here's another section. How do you train, or how do you give education along this line? I mentioned this yesterday, and here it is again. You can teach a behavior, but how do you develop character? I was explaining this in a home program once. The challenge that modern education is finding in developing character, like, with Columbine and so many series of very violent acts in our modern education system, and the educators have realized we have education systems that teach information but not education systems that develop character. So if you have information, you have something very powerful to put in the hands of someone that doesn't have character, what happens? Very dangerous. So recognizing that deficiency, educators have been trying and failing to understand how to develop character. I was describing this, and somebody in the audience started convulsing. I thought they were had a medical problem. They just stopped and said, are you okay? And they burst out in tears. Think, I'm an educator. I've been educated for my life, and it's true what you're saying. The Board of Education, all over the state, have been working on this, and we tried this and tried that, and we're clueless how to do this. And I said, well, obviously, you're a very dedicated educator. I wouldn't feel so strongly like this. But has the discussion ever gone into the arena of maybe it has something to do with separation of church and state? I mean, you just kicked that out of the picture, and now you try to develop character. Maybe that has a clue of why you're not able to develop character. We can't even go there. We can't have God in the schools. We have to develop character without God in the schools. Good luck. So, it has to be somewhere. It has to be in the home. But it's a little challenging if it's in your home and it's not in the schools. And how much time are your children in the home, and how much time are your children in the schools? And it's not just your children, it's, compulsory education. Everyone has to go to school till you're 18. It's a law. Some education system must be there. So, how do you do it? How do you teach children gratitude? You can teach them to say, please, and thank you. But how do you teach them the feeling of gratitude? Think about it. All over the world, it's please and thank you, whatever the language is, but gratitude, or respect, or compassion. And without these, like Christ said, knowledge is empty. The Vedic picture has an answer. And the answer is through association with those that have good qualities, like the quality of compassion. At least the opportunity is provided. where one can develop a similar quality. From Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Sangat Sanjayate Kama. By the association you keep, you develop qualities like that. So when you have the association of a quality person, Srila Prabhupada liberally gave his association all over the world, but not everyone developed that same mood that he had, so something else is necessary. When you have that association, one's heart must be open for transformation inside to take place, some receptivity, some openness to that association. Oops. And when that, through the course of interacting with quality, elevated, compassionate souls, faith or trust, just as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, those who are faithless, mogasya moga karma no moga jnana vicheta saha, they're defeated before they even begin. All of their good intentions are destroyed without faith, or are finished. And in the Vedic model, another very important dimension is a deep and genuine relationship with teacher, between teacher and a student. In Vedic culture, the role of the teacher, or the role of education, was not just passing on information, albeit the information was very rich, very deep. But the real purpose of education is developing character. Prabhupada was very clear about that with the Gurukul system that he was establishing. Less emphasis on academic, great emphasis on character. His point was, if a child or if an individual has character, you can teach them anything. And if the child or the individual doesn't have character, better you not teach them anything, because they'll misuse it, or they won't be able to receive it in a proper way. Most important thing is developing character. That's real education. Just as Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita, when Arjuna asks him, what is knowledge, jnanam, and the object of knowledge? Well, Krishna is the object of knowledge, but knowledge is, read the verses and its qualities. Real knowledge is character. Because from one's character, behavior comes. Everything comes. And if it's bad character, then bad behavior. Okay. So, I'm going to skip what I say about this image and just go to the text. Somehow it's not showing properly. I'm going to spend a little bit of time discussing the Vedic conception or picture of how you can develop compassion, or how you can work with an individual, a child or an adult or whoever, someone, to awaken the quality of compassion. And it's based upon the Vedic concept of Swabhava. What does Swabhava mean? Anybody?
Nature.
So Sva means one's own. And Bhava means mood or emotion or feeling. So one's own nature. But that one's own nature is defined in Bhagavad Gita in terms of the gunas. So when in contact with Brahma karma swabhavajam, Kshatriya karma swabhavajam, Vaishya karma swabhavajam. Swabhava okay. It's giving you a no.
Final comment.
It's giving you a yes now. Okay. Put him on the spot. Here's the image for the Western audience that doesn't know what the term Svabhava means. So this is a picture to help explain that's the term. I like Sanskrit terms because when first hearing them, these, I don't know what they mean. So it's like a blank slate. I don't have any preconceptions of anything. And hearing Prabhupada over and over again, it then that the word becomes a symbol. Because that's what words are. The symbols of something. So the symbol of Svabhava is this. Here's the soul in the center. And of course the soul is surrounded by or enveloped by two material manifestations. The subtle body, mind, intelligence, and false ego, and the gross body. Earth, water, fire, air, ether. So within those two, gross and subtle bodies, there's the soul, of course, animating both the gross and subtle bodies. But they're not in a vacuum. They're being acted upon by the modes of nature. So this is the mode of goodness, sattva, acting upon the gross and subtle bodies. And it's not just the mode of goodness. The mode of passion is also acting. And the mode of ignorance is also acting. But they're not acting upon the soul. They're acting upon the coverings of the soul. And according to the nature of the modes of nature, the modes of gunas, then one is said to have a certain svabhava. The brahma karma svabhava jam is when the mode of goodness is predominant. And when they're acting, then you get certain behaviors. Sama dhamakta paksho cham chantir arjavam evacha. Those are behaviors that are based upon svabhava. From one's, I'll just say it again, from one's quality, behaviors come. So if you want to have this behavior, the behavior of compassion, you develop the quality of goodness. So if you have a child, you have an adult, you have a person, you have yourself, and you like to develop compassion, increase the quality of goodness in your life. Frame your life in the quality of goodness as far as possible. The indicators of food in the quality of goodness, and knowledge in the quality of goodness, and happiness in the quality of goodness, and increase the quality of goodness. Be regulated in your habits, be very clean, be truthful. Practice increasing goodness and brahma karma svabhavajam. Compassion will follow. But the mode of goodness is not always prominent, and the other modes are competing for supremacy. We know this from Bhagavad Gita. And so we need to keep our attention upon Krishna, transcendental goodness, and then this quality of goodness becomes predominant. And compassionate becomes your way of life. So, compassion is a trait in the quality or the mode of goodness. And an example of this is help me. Maharaj Nimi. You know the story of Maharaj Nimi? Would you like to hear it? Like it or not, here it comes. Maharaj Nimi was a very great king, and he was very compassionate. He was very self-sacrificing. So magnanimous and charitable was Maharaj Nimi that whatever he had in his treasury, they wouldn't have to come and ask, he would just give it. And one of the things that helped replenish his treasury was he was very pious. He underwent various austerities to accrue piety, but he would very generously distribute that piety, the fruits of his austerities, to others. So one time he decided to have a 100-day fast. Some persons here, I'm sure, fast for different festival days, Jamastami at least, and Nishringa Chaturdasi. There's these 4 days at least. What are the 4 days? Gaur Purnima, Janmashtami,
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appearance.
Huh?
Appearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
That's Gaura Purnima, Janmashtami, the Srila Chaturdasi, Ram Nomi. These four Prabhupada gave us at their full day fasts. And it's nice to have some persons have full day fasts for Ekadasi or different things on in our Vaishnava calendar. Fasting for one full day, that's nice. Fasting for more than one day, that's a little more difficult. Maharaj Nimi was very accomplished. He was fasting for 100 days. That's pretty intense. And on the morning after that long fast, the royal kitchen prepared a royal feast, and he sat down in his royal throne and was prepared to break the fast. And just as he was ready to break the fast, a brahmana came right into the royal assembly, and Maharaj Nimi was very cultured. King immediately got down from his throne, paid respects to the brahmana, said, "How auspicious, just as I was about to break my fast, you've come kindly honor me, break the fast first, and then I'll break my fast." So the brahmana, being very honored by the king, he sat down in the very seat of the king and ate half and left the other half for the king. So after the brahmana left, Maharaj Nimi sat down to complete breaking his fast, and just as he was about to begin, one man with a bunch of little puppies came into the royal assembly and said, "Oh, my puppies are really hungry. You have something?" "Oh yes, I have some nice royal food here for your puppies. Please take it." And what was left was some water. So he's going to break the fast with water. And just as he was about to drink some water, a very poor mendicant came. "Oh, I'm very thirsty. Can I have something for me to drink?" And the king said, before he gave him the water, he said, "What great fortune it is for anyone to be able to sacrifice up their lives for the well-being and welfare of others. What more could one ask for in one's life than such opportunity? My dear sir, please take." And as you see in the upper left corner, the rest of the narration in the Bhagavatam is that the brahmana, the man with the puppies, as well as mendicant, they were Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, and Lord Indra. They appeared in those forms just to test, because they heard that Nimi was very magnanimous and compassionate and charitable. But they wanted to see, is there some limit? And they realized there's no limit. His life was simply serving other people. And so they gave him this benediction that after you complete your life, you attain spiritual perfection from this quality of compassion. Contemporary is, example is Mother Teresa. Her whole life was simply serving other people with whatever it is that God put in her hands. She used that in a compassionate way for others. But compassion is not only or restricted to doing something that directly seems to be an act of kindness, just like this is Maharaj Parikshit, who is with his sword raised, is ready to destroy personality of Kali, who with that club down there was breaking the legs of the bull. So a king may show compassion by protecting those who are innocent, and that may be up to the point of using some strong action. So we don't go walking around with a chopper and chop people because they're doing something bad. But there is, those who are in the position of kings or leaders in government, they have some duty that may also be an act of compassion, although that's not easy for some people to understand. Two more ideas, and we're done. Something that I've often thought about is, and Prabhupada teaches about it, how compassion can be misplaced. One of the common examples that Prabhupada gave was the drowning man. and I'll try to make it a little bit colorful. There was a skit, the drowning man, and the man is drowning, and you go and save his jacket, and the man drowns. So, in our Sunday feast lecture, it was staged, and nobody knew what the two people were doing, the person giving the lecture, and the devotee in the audience. And the devotee in the audience, I'll not give his name, but he's like an eccentric person. But he was in the audience, sitting down, and the lecturer began the class, and Jai Radha Madhava, the class began, started speaking, and at a certain point, the eccentric devotee in the audience started calling out very loudly in the middle of class, "Help! Help!" And he's screaming and screaming, and everyone's looking at him, "What's wrong?" And the person that was the speaker got over, and he got out of the seat and went over and, "Are you okay, Prabhu? And is everything all right? Help! Help!" So he took his chatur and went back and sat on Vyasa-san. As a way of illustrating, you can save the garment of the drowning man, but if you don't help the drowning man, what have you done? Or the person in difficulty. Everyone got the message. It was very effective. Drama is very effective, can be very effective. So, if you save the coat of the drowning man, but the man drowns, nice gesture, but it's really important to save the person who is drowning, not just the coat of the person. Similarly, the soul is the real self. So when there's acts of compassion, it's not just for the well-being of the circumstance in which the soul finds itself, but the soul. Real compassion is, it goes to the platform of the soul. So misplaced compassion is not paying attention to the root of the suffering, the fact that the soul is in this unfortunate circumstance, in this embodied state. And taking the soul to a more comfortable embodied state or a less comfortable embodied state isn't really the true act of compassion. It's incomplete. Here's another example, another nice kitty cat. And this is just something that happened to me when I was young. I grew up in upstate New York near Syracuse. And probably over here you don't know too much about New York state geography, but it's a very nice place. It's the Finger Lakes area, the central part of the state. And in that area, I don't know if it's still going on, but when I was 5 or 6 years old, there was an infestation of locusts. Little guys about that big and wings, and they go in swarms, like hundreds of thousands of them when they come in. The sky is like night, although it's middle of the day, there's so many of them. And they land in the agricultural fields and they just eat up everything. You can hear them. And when everything's gone, they just fly to the next field, and then they go on the trees and eat all the foliage, and everything is, it's really awful. So my parents made a mistake. They gave me a spray thing of black flag poison to go in the garage and spray the garage so that we wouldn't have any locusts in the garage. So I was spraying in the garage and saw a little kitty cat. And I thought, if I spray the kitty cat, she won't have any problem with locusts either. So I sprayed the cat and sprayed the cat and sprayed the cat, and then unfortunately, the next morning when we got up, the cat was dead in the garage. And I felt terrible. To this day, I feel badly about it. That wasn't our cat, it was another cat. But I realized from a young boy that good intention is not good enough. Or you can mean well, you can try to express yourself in a compassionate way, but it may be to the detriment of the other party. So you can misplace compassion. You need to know what's the right way to express compassion. It's good having compassion, but it can be harmful. And Arjuna himself had misplaced compassion. We know from the beginning parts of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna had to redirect his compassion to the platform of the soul. And once on the platform of the soul, then it was the best form of expression of his compassion. A Vedic example is the story of Bharat Maharaj. Do you guys know who Bharat Maharaj is?
Yeah.
Who is he? You forgot, right? Okay. Do you know? Okay. See, you're honest. And you're pretending.
I know his name.
Okay. He was a king. He was one of the 100 sons of Rishabhdev. He was such a great king, Rishabhdev. Rishabhdev is an incarnation of the personality of Godhead. Rishabhdev, Bharat Maharaj was such a great king that they named the whole planet after him. That's pretty good, pretty big, right? Like there's probably some streets around here that are from some president or some important person. Many streets and avenues in America, Martin Luther King Boulevard or like that, named after. It's so common in India. It's common all over the world. When I was young, the airport in Queens was Idlewild Airport. Then John F. Kennedy became president and he stopped being president and they renamed it John F. Kennedy International Airport. It's like that. Things are named after people. Bharat Maharaj was such a big king, important king. They renamed the whole planet after him, Bharat Varsha. And during his rule as king, he became very, very elevated in spiritual life. He left his kingdom in the charge of his sons, went to the forest to meditate on. Who is that in the background? Four arms.
Vishnu.
Surya Narayan. He was chanting the Gayatri Mantra, meditating upon Surya Narayan. And he so elevated, he saw the form of Vishnu. And he attained the stage of Bhava Bhakti. Specifically, it's described in the Bhagavatam. Just before the stage of Prema Bhakti, he was up there. Very, very spiritually advanced. Then, one unfortunate day, something happened. As he was meditating early in the morning by the side of the river, having finished his bath, he was meditating and chanting his Gayatri mantra. And on the opposite side, there was a pregnant deer. And the deer, you've seen how deer move. She was drinking water and then looking, then drinking some more water, looking around, very fearful that danger might come. And while she was in the midst of doing that, a lion gave a loud roar, much louder than that. And the deer leaped in the air, hearing that sound, and fell in the river. As she leaped, she had a miscarriage. The commentaries describe that when a woman is in a pregnant condition, she should be very careful. Others should be very careful that are taking care. That there not be something that's very frightening or traumatic, because when that happens, there can be miscarriage. That's what happened to the deer. The baby deer fell into the river. She was washed away by the swift moving river, went to the side and crawled into a cave and died. And then there's this baby deer floating down the river. And there's Bharat Maharaj sitting by the side of the river. What's he going to do? He went and saved the baby deer, which was an act of compassion. A perfectly appropriate act of compassion for a king, because a king gives protection to his subjects. And not just the human type of subject, but all. And he understood the dependence of the deer, because the deer had no mother, the deer had no father, the deer had no one to take care of him except one person, the king. So he came to anything for that little baby deer. And instead of being very elevated in Krishna consciousness, he became deer conscious. To the extent where even when he was doing his practices, he was totally distracted. Instead of fixing his mind upon the Supreme, he was unable to even do his duties. In fact, he stopped his duties. In fact, he consciously rationalized. There's like verses and verses and verses where he consciously gave up his spiritual practices and his spiritual goal in favor of being deer conscious. So one day the deer went away, and he was, there's like verses and verses of his thought process, thinking, I'm just this offensive being, this deer is so elevated and pious, and I've not served the deer properly, and I've offended them, and so they've gone away. But the deer is very pious and elevated, surely they'll be forgiving and come back, and like on and on and on, and verses and verses, and the deer didn't come back. The whole night passed, he was up sleepless at night, worrying about where is the deer. Early the next morning, he went looking for the deer. Unfortunately, he fell off a cliff. And when he fell off the cliff, he was thinking of the deer. And because he was thinking of the deer, when he gave up his body, what happened? He became a deer. So, the problem is not that he made an act of compassion. The problem was he misplaced the compassion to be exclusively upon the body, and as a result he forgot his own spiritual well-being, or to speak of the spiritual well-being of the deer he was trying to assist. Better he had been a sadhu and the deer was living as deers live, but he abandoned all that. And so misplaced compassion can have very serious consequences. So now, last section here is, I described swabhava, or how one's involvement in the modes of nature can manifest compassion. But is there such a thing as the swabhava of the soul? Is there a quality that all souls have that besides what mode of nature you're influenced by, is there a natural compassion that's resting within the soul itself? There's a contemporary field now that's called self-compassion. One of the proponents of this self-compassion is Dr. Kristen Neff, one of many. She's a counselor, a therapist of some kind, and she's found in the course of her profession that some people, she's unable to go forward with assisting them because they're too hard on themselves. They beat themselves up, or if they can be forgiving of other people, but they can't be forgiving of themselves. If they make a mistake, they obsess over that mistake, or that shortcoming, or that weakness. Or they just extend and extend and extend and extend and extend, and they deplete themselves in their efforts of being compassionate. So, to others, to be compassionate to others, one of the principles is you have to be able to receive compassion. If you can, you can't give something to others that you don't have. So to give compassion or be compassionate, you have to be able to receive it, including being kind to yourself. And kind to yourself doesn't mean, here's the question: is self-compassion real compassion, or is it just self-indulgence, narcissism? The answer is, if it's on the platform of the soul, then it's not. If self-compassion goes to the platform of the soul, so how do you get to the platform of the soul? how to take self-compassion to the platform of the soul. In the age of Kali, there is great turmoil. It's an ocean of faults. It's a very degraded age all around. And to find others to associate with who have these elevated qualities, unlike the age of Kali, very difficult. Or to help another person come to the stage of being or receiving compassion or being compassionate, it's on the platform of the soul, it's very difficult. The age of Kali, everything's difficult. So, is there a solution? The Vedic model has a solution, and the Vedic model solution is through sound vibration, through this very primal, very simple activity of situating oneself in transcendental sound. Chanting of God's holy name is the most easily accessible transcendental sound, and by that method, that spiritual consciousness awakens. Simply by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, one can become free from material bondage and be promoted to the transcendental kingdom. This is from the section of the Bhagavatam, the 12th canto, where the age of Kali is described, and the remedy of the age of Kali is described, this chanting of Krishna's holy name. And it works. Persons that are not at all of spiritual quality, in the assembly of others who are chanting Krishna's holy name, it's transforming. So whether in this form, like in congregational chanting, or solitary practice of chanting Krishna's holy name, it's the most effective means in this age of Kali for awakening our dormant spiritual consciousness, and from that platform of the soul to act with self-compassion or compassion to others. It can stay on that spiritual platform if we take the right means. And this is the final slide back to where we began. The awakening of our Krishna consciousness is the directly doing this through the process of hearing and chanting, as our scriptures give us. It can accomplish this awakening of this wonderful quality. It's important. One of the things that I feel that's very important for devotees to be conscious of or be concerned about is the chanting of Krishna's holy name is very powerful, very potent. We're not qualified, but even though not qualified, it will help us, uplift us, awaken our higher, finer attributes and qualities that are covered by this age of Kali or the influence of Kali. How we manifest the natural compassion that does come, it's very important for us to both continue on our spiritual journey in an upwards or elevated condition, and to direct that compassion so that it's most effective to be of benefit for others. So the Bharat Maharaj story is very relevant. It doesn't say, you know, don't help a helpless creature because you might have a problem. Creatures or persons, whoever, are helpless. Doing something for them you're not human if you fail in that regard. But stay fixed on the spiritual objective. The spiritual objective is ultimately the well-being of the soul, delivering souls to the spiritual position. It's easy to get lost in the material circumstance and be drawn in to another position of forgetfulness in our own lives or in our family or the community or the world. Compassionate behavior is something that a spiritually minded person will do. Stay fixed on the spiritual objective. The soul, the soul's connection with the Supreme. Then we'll be the best instruments of Krishna and of the best service for others. It's by that quality of Krishna consciousness. Okay. And there and see if there's any discussion. Yes?
Thank you very much, Maharaj, for the wonderful class. Extending the level of compassion to the other species, especially living in the state of Kali when the so-called heads of government do not support certain propaganda, then that becomes a little challenging for devotees. So, in that regard, what is the strategy, I should say, that we should all endeavor for so that that particular thing can be effective?
What's the strategy?
Basically, preaching strategy, to be able to convince and get them so that the other species are, you know, protected and intact. Like,
I don't know if it's so much a question of strategy as purity. I don't see that Prabhupada had a particular strategy on rescuing other species other than the strategy of propagating Srimad Bhagavatam through the message of pure devotion. But by the impact of Krishna consciousness, here's what the devotees in Australia said, because in Australia in the past it was, has been percentage wise one of the strongest meat eating and specifically beef eating countries of the world. Large tracts of land for grazing and so on and so on. So a huge percentage of the population was engaged in that activity. In the 2 decades or so of Prabhupada's vigorously teaching Prabhupada's message, the number of slaughterhouses went down a huge number, and the percentage of meat went down a huge percentage. There was no specific strategy out there in the world of, you know, stop the slaughterhouses. And just the awakening of Krishna consciousness and the necessity of moving in the direction of vegetarianism had a powerful impact before these organizations existed, PETA and all of them. So the strategy was purity and propagating the message of Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. And by that purity, it spawns the quality of goodness, and, you know, the social activism is already going to be there. You know, our most effective strategy is purity. Awakening the spiritual consciousness of the population as vigorously as we can through chanting and propagating the message, and such activist organizations will create the strategy. Like one time Prabhupada was asked, Swamiji, your movement is growing so rapidly. Maybe one day you'll be elected the president of the country. And Prabhupada just laughed and shook his head and said, we're not interested in becoming president of the country. Then he paused and said, maybe we would advise the president. That's our role. That's our strategy. Awakening Krishna consciousness. And through awakening of Krishna consciousness, we can be, you know, synergistically involved with or appreciated by giving our moral support to persons that are doing that work. But the real interest, because very quickly those interests go to the material platform. It starts on the material platform. Although it's motive goodness, and it just stays on the material platform. We're not a vegetarian society. We're not a non-violent society. We're a Krishna conscious society. Our strategy is to promote Krishna consciousness. Anything else? Yes.
Krishna always says in Bhagavad Gita, surrender unto me. So what is exactly surrender?
What exactly does surrender unto me mean? Yes? Well, one way to answer that is from Padma Purana. There's a verse that states that there are six angas of surrender. It's mentioned in Nectar Devotion also, quoting or references Padma Purana. Anukulyasya sankalpa pratikulyasya varjanam. Those are the first two. The symptoms of surrender are, or angas of surrender are, accepting everything that's favorable for serving Krishna. And if something's not favorable for serving Krishna, reject. Then, in that position of accepting things favorable, rejecting things unfavorable, as one progresses, there's a sense that Krishna is my protector and Krishna is my maintainer. Rakshishatiti vishvaso gopritve varanam tava. So in material life, one is very like the deer that was drinking the water. Anyone that's living in this material body, we're vulnerable. So there's fear. But when you're feeling protected, that fear is gone. So Krishna is my protector. Krishna is my maintainer. Another very important animal drive is I need to take care of my necessities. If my consciousness is that of surrender, then I'm working in a surrendered mood, Krishna will maintain me. And the last two are humility, dānya, and there are different versions, but full self-surrender, ātma-nivedana. That is the dedication of body, mind, and words unto Krishna's service. That's what Sharanam means. Six different components. Things that make up, you know, deciding what we'll do and what we'll not do. Our sense of fear or being protected. Our sense of maintaining ourselves. Our how we view ourselves in a humble or the absence of in a prideful way, and the object, dedication of all things unto Krishna. That's the symptoms of surrender. A far more expanded version of, you know, what I just said is the songs of Bhaktivinoda Thakur called Sharanagati. He takes those six angas of surrender and has a number of songs to expand on each one of the six. Five songs up to like 13 songs in one section explaining what that means. The consciousness of one who is feeling themselves protected by Krishna, one who is feeling themselves maintained by Krishna, one who is feeling genuine humility before Krishna. Yes?
So the question is, Bharat Maharaj, who was constantly acting in compassion until he left the body. But the only problem asking was the place in universe because it was not having a spiritual objective. That is
He neglected the objective. He neglected the practice to reach the objective purposely, consciously. I mean, he rationalized the whole thing away. This is not good, but I'm going to do it anyways because of these reasons. He made a conscious choice to neglect.
So he was already on a spiritual platform.
But he left it.
So
one can leave the spiritual platform by choice. That's what he did.
So when it is not on a spiritual platform, one should not act on compassion?
No. You should, if you're on the spiritual platform, you should act on the spiritual platform at the same time you're looking at the, you know, the holistic picture of the individual encased in a body and a mind. You may give compassionate assistance to that person on the platform of the body and the mind, but ultimately is to elevate or lift free the soul from material entanglement. And if you're not on the platform of the soul, all you know is the body or mind, the coverings. And that's ineffective. Am I addressing your question? You want to go further with it, or you're okay? You got a little question mark in your forehead.
So, the action one performs is, we can tell on what platform he is. So, deviating from that platform, from where he should be acting accordingly, that means he has fallen down. So.
No. The fact that he saved the deer was right. It was the right action. So what was missing was the consciousness behind the action. It started out okay. So it wasn't like, if you save a deer, you're in big trouble, so don't save any deers. That's not the message. If, in the course of doing so, you forget your spiritual well-being and the spiritual well-being of the other entity, you're going down the wrong path. Your compassion is misplaced. Arjun, just put your hand down. Oh, after him, I'll call on you, okay? Arjuna was feeling compassion. Krishna gave him an A for compassion and asked for where he was reposing it. Compassion is good. But it needs to be rightly placed. What Krishna did was he indicated to Arjuna, place compassion upon the well-being of the soul. And once the well-being of the soul is then fixed, then you can consider what's best for the circumstance of the body and the mind. Follow? It's like a mathematical, Prabhupada's example. If you have a mathematical equation and it's a long series of computations, at the very beginning you make a mistake, you may do many other calculations very, very carefully, very nicely, perfect. You can get the wrong answer. You can't just, you know, tweak it. You have to go right back to the very beginning and correct the calculation that was wrong. And then complete the calculations following that. And you get the right answer. So the fundamental thing is the object of compassion is not the soul. All the other good calculations are going to be good efforts are misdirected. So when, you know, going to Haiti or going to Japan or, you know, doing things that are helping others in a distressed condition, do those things mindful of the spiritual position from the beginning and the middle and in the end, then you'll be doing the best service for the other as well as for yourself. Make that mistake and both for yourself and the other, it could be, you know, either ineffective or worse. harmful. Okay, he had a very enthusiastic question up front here. Or maybe a comment?
No, just
okay.
A question.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a question and a comment.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Go for it.
I think...
That's a good degree.
Actually, is the moral of the story that when you save someone, you shouldn't... When you save someone at any disaster, you shouldn't get too attached to it, and you still have to do devotional service to Krishna? Or?
Yeah, something like that. So if you're going to do something for others, it's quite easy to get attached to the fact that you're doing something good for others and find some sense of happiness and I'm doing something for others. And, like, completely forget Krishna in the whole picture. And completely even forget about what is the ultimate well-being of that other person or other being you just did something for. Like, lose your Krishna consciousness. And that's, you know, that's not what the objective of devotional service is, to lose your Krishna consciousness. The objective of devotional service is to see that Krishna is pleased and the others who you're working in the assembly of, that their Krishna consciousness grows too. That's the objective. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. That was your question. Is that the comment too?
No.
Okay.
So that's a question.
Okay.
Maharaj, you brought a really great place for just the field of counseling.
Yeah.
Things that you can apply.
Yeah.
And just thinking about how could you best give services to another person through the field of counseling or being a counselor. I mean, one way you mentioned is through being in the spiritual position in your own life. But how would it be appropriate to expose someone in a professional setting to spiritual life to make the next step so that they really can solve their problems through, you know, having a spiritual life, and how would you think that would be appropriate where you know, you could keep on seeing a client and expose that to them?
A lot depends on the client. A lot depends on you. I mean, if from your side, the more you're Krishna conscious, that means, you know, you're with the client and you're conscious of Krishna. You're conscious of, I am Krishna's instrument here. And Krishna has placed me here where if I just have my light on, if I, you know, hello, I've got the Krishna channel on, Krishna can then guide me how to help this person in some spiritual way. But if I'm not Krishna conscious, then Krishna could be hollering and I won't hear it. And then the other person, let me see where they are and let me see if there's some willingness and like a little trust on their side to take a step towards what you know, we're going to call for the time being a more spiritual direction in their life, whatever that might be. If there's enough trust, then let's see if they're willing to go one step. Because I know that spiritual well-being precedes the material well-being. The problem, the root of the problem is a spiritual malaise, not just something else. It's, you know, an external circumstance that needs some relief. It's a spiritual problem at the root. So if they allow me in there, and if there's a little trust, then according to their language and, you know, their way of, you know, viewing things, take a step. It's just that little step will be very empowering. You don't have to give it a name that I'm familiar with and they're unfamiliar with. But let it be the language that they're familiar with. And then one step.
Whatever religion it is,
we're on their side of the bridge,
right.
And they're comfortable, whatever their language, their terminology, a step. Because they're, you know, it's... There's your professional ethics, and there's their sensibilities, and you know, but then there's the ground ultimate spiritual reality. So if I can do some things to help give them some tools, give them some self-confidence, some self-empowerment, and a little spiritual direction, maybe that's the best that I can do. Sometimes compassion is waiting for the right moment, the right circumstance. Because if you want to, the idea is that there's something received, and if someone may not be in a position to receive, you have to wait.
How do we differentiate when the appropriate time?
Prompts will come. I'm thinking now specifically of a circumstance where I was visiting in Houston, and we had a series of programs. We just like canceled one program because the teenage son committed suicide. No, was in a car accident and died, like a horrible car accident. So our service wasn't just to go give a Bhagavad Gita class. Our service was to comfort them. And by extending that which was their greatest need at that time, it was just on, you know, a basic human level. In the course of a few days, they started asking the questions. It wasn't the right time. Oh, don't worry, the soul is eternal. You know, they weren't going to be ready to hear that. You just, like the devotees, just took over the household duties, did all the cooking, did all the cleaning, did all the everything. You just, like, you know, take care of the necessities, and you didn't even talk so much, like, you know, philosophy. But they felt so much support. They had some idea that we had spiritual answers. That wasn't what was the first thing coming. First thing coming was just being there, supporting them. And end the discussion. To their time.
So like in a hospice situation where the person is suffering and they're not able to necessarily hear the philosophy, some people would say, if they're suffering so much, what's the quality of their life? Couldn't we just help them commit suicide? You know, as a devotee, that doesn't fly.
No.
But so how do we... So just by being supportive and being compassionate.
Well, again, it's like this other question of your capacity and the other individual's position. But when the light's going out, generally a greater spiritual receptivity is present. You know, the temporary shelters are gone. So what's left? And you know, you have to look at the person and the relationship that has the amount of trust that is there with the person. It's all very, you know, super soul inspired kind of thing. Very delicate. You have to do it carefully, otherwise they just shut down. You have something?
Question. So, in talking to some of my colleagues at work, as long as we talk about similarities like compassion and things like that, distributing food or various other things, there's a lot of agreement and there's a lot of, you know, approval. And the moment with most of such people, the moment I think, okay, let's introduce a little bit extra or talk about a little bit extra and say like about meat eating, immediately there is a withdrawal that I observe. And so my question is, and then they say, okay, Bible says that it's, you know, and a lot of reasons, a lot of details I won't go into. So is it even required or should to tell some of these people who work very closely with me, they are not just very strangers, you know.
Okay, that's a key factor, work closely. The message that I presented before was, when you extend, when there's trust, people will start asking questions, and that's the time to start to say. When they ask you, why do you eat the way that you eat, then you can say, or you could put it as a question. Have you ever wondered why I bring my food from home, or why I don't eat all these other things? But you know, if there's a inquisitiveness, then you can present in that close work environment. Because otherwise, you know, it feels like to them you're pushing your religion on them, you're pushing your beliefs on them. You don't want that push back. Let them come to the point of disrespecting you by your character, by your quality, by your kindness, your spirituality, your even temperedness, you know, consistently. When that respect for you as a spiritual being becomes elevated, then questions will arise, and as they arise, you can present.
So just having faith that it's a matter of time, and it could be years.
Well, yeah, they
will ask.
Yes, but you know, if there's again the super soul prompt that tells you, here's a person that's a little more receptive, and if I speak something, they're. At least my perception is, my intuition is, they're not going to feel like I'm like proselytizing, dumping my views on them and trying to convert them. Because then there'll be a pushback. You've lost the equity in that relationship. But so, you know, go forward gently. And when you feel some pushback, you step back. Better that they have some. Therefore, there's a wonderful verse in the 10th canto of Bhagavatam, the chapter where Krishna steals the garments of the gopis. Towards the end of the chapter, there's a series of verses where Krishna and Balaram are walking through the forest, and Krishna is appreciating the trees and how they're serving everyone. Goes through the details and then says that the standard of life should be where we serve others by our life, by our wealth, by our intelligence, or by our words. So what you don't want to lose is that person's regard for a devotee. You, because you're representing Krishna. You may not think of it precisely in that way, but you're representing Krishna in that particular environment. So their regard for you as a person is very important in terms of their regard for Krishna. You don't want to, like, you know, cut that regard before they start to, like, they pull back and push you away. Because, you know, if they perceive you as and truly, of being a pushy person. At the same time, compassion is there. You want to do something, but, you know, let the circumstance be right. It's like the same point. And it can be very slow. But let it go forward where there are persons that you get a signal, a super soul signal that says, this person can take a step. There's a degree of trust in them that I can speak something and they're not going to... Maybe just engage them in the way they like to be engaged. Like you say, the prasadam distribution, and by being with devotees, many devotees are very happy, they're very kind, but then there's this spiritual component in them, and they'll become at least curious, if not attracted. And then they'll start asking. You know, one thing can lead to the next thing rather than going right away. Especially because you have some, you know, you're side by side with them in the workplace every day. They see that you're happy. They see that you're peaceful. They see that you're very balanced. I think he wants your attention. Okay?
So I have a question.
Yeah.
Behavior we can learn from parents and teacher,
yeah,
and mentor, but compassion, how I can improve my compassion? Is it I born with, or...
Is it what?
I born with, like, again?
Not exactly, more like osmosis. How do you, if you're cold, how do you get warm? You go stand near a fire.
Yes.
And you'll get warm.
Yes.
So find someone compassionate and just stand by them.
Okay. And I have a
and serve them. And then you'll develop similar quality.
I have a practical experience living in New York. Not too far from the temple in New York.
Okay.
And I used to take subway. I attended the Library of Congress.
Okay.
So in India, we just see older people disrespectfully.
Sure.
Sit down.
Sure.
Take the.
Sure.
And I did it in New York the first time in my experience. That gentleman was a little bit older.
Yeah.
And he just get really angry. He said, "You're going to fight with me?" And I struggled with him. And I said, "Sorry, I don't mean that. But I thought you were really, really hurt." So I said, "Barely sit down."
Different culture, huh? Still, you should, you know, observe culture, because culture is universal. Maybe somebody is mistrustful, but you show culture. Don't worry. Don't put you off. Okay. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada ki.
It's all in the short time, Maharaj ki.